some kind of restlessness. I find I'm haunted by some kind of restlessness. And it won't let me go. And it won't let me go. Part the waters, move the ocean, split the sea. Let me pass underneath. Part the waters, move the ocean, split the sea. Let me pass underneath.
You are standing on the banks of the sea. The dusty wind whirls. The salty sea smacks muddy banks. The horizon shimmers with hope for the free. The promises are near. Land, life, liberty. You hear the Pharaoh's chariots, pompous power that crushes life's, leather whips lashing horses' hides, soldiers' breasts, slavery's frets, horses' hoofs closing the gap. Your feet sink into the sand, deeper and deeper. You are stunned. This wasn't the plan. Your choice is not easy. Risky freedom or safe slavery. Do you step forward or do you turn back?
I find I'm haunted by some kind of brokenness. I find I'm haunted by some kind of brokenness. And it won't let me go. And it won't let me go. Part the waters, move the ocean, split the sea. Let me pass underneath. Part the waters, move the ocean, split the sea. Let me pass underneath.
You are standing on the banks of the sea. Feet sinking, fears gripping, knees shaking. You're scared of everything that could be. How the kids are going to grow, if the cash will start to flow, what the future might hold, feeling loved when you are old, standing strong when all's awash, living again with courage and panache, looking beautiful inside and out, being abandoned, alone, left out, moving on when love is lost, finding meaning when dreams squashed.
And you won't let me go. And you won't let me go.
Your choice is not easy. Risky freedom or safe slavery. Do you step forward or do you turn back? But you are not alone today. Your king leads the way. Dance and sting and step and play. Old rule wanes. Jesus now reigns, breaking these chains. Your choice is not easy. What do you want to be? Slave or free? In chapter 9 of the book of Acts, we see the Apostle Paul, the one who will become one of the famous saints in the Christian church. And at that moment in his life, he is lashing his horse's hide in pursuit of the early Christians. He's got official documents from Jerusalem to arrest, to try, and to squelch the early movement of Christianity. But then everything changes. He sees a light on that road to Damascus. He remembers Israel's long story and the ways of God and the blessing that is for all people. He recommits himself to a new sense of mission and vision to recreate the world with God, to bind up what was broken in our world. Paul was at one time in his life like one of the Pharaoh's chariots, his breath chasing down someone else. But then Paul moved to be as one that is standing on the banks of the sea, longing for freedom with those other early Christian companions along the way. And Paul chose the risky step of freedom. And what's amazing about how the story goes is that Paul learned more about what it meant to follow this ancient rabbi, to follow this way, he committed himself ever more and ever more to this path. But one question we have to ask is, what was the heart of Paul's teaching? What was this risky freedom that he wanted to share with the whole world? And the passage today sheds light. It's a snapshot into this incredible journey that was early Christianity. And the story goes something like this. Paul journeys to Thessalonica with Silas. And as Paul did in every city that he visited, he went into the synagogue and they had a lively conversation about what the Bible meant. A synagogue is a place in the ancient world for worship and for prayer, to meet together in the city village and also to dialogue deeply, to converse back and forth about what this whole story in the Bible is about. So Paul shows up in their synagogue with Silas, and for 3 weeks straight, he's teaching the people. He's engaging in dialogue. And this is what he's saying. He says in verse 3 that the Messiah had to suffer but was risen again. And so these are some code words for ancient Jews. First, Messiah. This is a word that had a lot of buzz on the city streets and in the countryside. Some people thought the Messiah was going to be a warrior king, someone that was going to take care of all of Israel's enemies. Some other people thought this Messiah was going to be more a political king, extending the borders of Israel, building up that beautiful temple in Jerusalem. And then, of course, there were those who had a mishmash of all of those in between, because in the first century, there was no job description for what Messiah could mean. But then there's Paul, who decides to say, put together Messiah and suffering. When he mentions suffering, that's a code word for the cross. In the Roman world where Jesus was born, the cross was about shame and dishonor. And so no one thought that a king, a Messiah, Messiah also means the anointed one, the king. No one thought that a Messiah, a king, would come and suffer on a cross. So to the Roman society, the cross was to die a criminal's death. Even more than that, not just a criminal, it was to die the death of someone who had stood up against Rome and been put down. So if you stole bread from the bakery, you wouldn't be put to the cross. But if you were a threat to Rome, you would be put to the cross. So Paul's saying to us, the Messiah had to suffer. So Paul is rereading all of the story of the Bible and saying, this suffering was what it's all about. And just like the looks you're looking at me right now, all the people in the synagogue must have said, say what, Paul? Or in Greek, epiti. And so as Paul is describing this new way of thinking about the story, There's dialogue, there's conversation, there's, what is this crazy guy Paul talking about from Jerusalem? What happened to him? He's off his rocker, right? Well, as the conversation goes on, Paul describes that this Messiah had to suffer and became a king. So Paul makes the radical and revolutionary claim that that rabbi from Galilee, that no-name place, that rabbi became the king of the world. To what everyone in the synagogue would say, say what? Epit? Seriously? And as Paul explains this to them, he explains that this kingdom was not like what we thought it was going to be. It wasn't a warrior king. It wasn't a political king. It was a king whose chief mission and vision was wrapped around love. And of course, you can imagine that one of the learned women stood up in the synagogue and explained for people the teachings of the rabbi Jesus from Galilee, his commitment to service, his commitment to forgive those who wronged you, his commitment to love even your enemies. And so Paul begins to remind them that this Messiah, this new king has come, but it looks a whole lot different than anything you could have expected. In fact, Jesus is the unexpected king that Paul proclaims to this synagogue. And as the synagogue's hearts are warmed and as their minds engage this message, things start to happen. Because what Paul is saying is that the entire world is under new management. What Paul is saying is that what some people think that the presidents and the principalities and the governors and the emperors of the world are under its control, what Paul is saying, the world is under God's control. Under unexpected control, under the control of the kingdom of love. So Paul was asking them to consider the radical claim that the gravitational pull of the universe has been changed. No longer is power and greed what the whole system works on. There is an underground movement of love amongst early Christians that they believed in, a movement that was one day going to grow and bloom and transform the world. Paul reminded them that the ancient promise of Israel was to bless all the nations, not just one nation, but all the nations. Paul was basically saying to them, it's not about red or blue, it's about something much bigger. It's about an entire world. It's about learning the rhythm of the kingdom of love, forgiveness, service, compassion for all. When you say things like that, in ancient synagogues, typically things don't go good for you. Not only do you get epit, but the passage tells us that there were some Jews that believed. There were some Greeks. Synagogues in the ancient world have a lot of Greeks and Romans that come in and out of them. We shouldn't be surprised at this. They were hungry to learn from the scripture as the Jews were. So some Jews believed, some Greeks believed, and then it tells us, and many of the prominent women believed. One remarkable thing about early Christianity is that all throughout the New Testament, women are held up as those who promoted the early Christian mission and vision. It's actually remarkable in the scripture 2,000 years ago to have women highlighted in the prominent leadership roles that they are. And so then there's a whole group that believes, but if you know church very well, there's a group that does not believe. And those groups can cause a whole lot of trouble. And so this small group of people, they go to the city authorities and they say, we want to arrest Paul and Silas. They go to Jason's house, who was taking care of Paul and Silas at the time. And they basically say, hey, send out Paul and Silas. Well, the early Christians were smart and they'd already hid Paul and Silas away. So out they say, we'll take Jason. So they bring Jason in front of the city authorities. And this is their claim. It's remarkable. They say, these are the very same people who've been turning the world upside down, and now they've come here. And imagine the city officials. What are they doing? Well, they're caring for the sick. They're loving enemies. They're showing compassion on the roadway to people. It's just totally messing up our world, you know? And then they make the second claim that they claim that Caesar is not the king, but the rabbi from Nazareth has become the king. That's remarkable. 2,000 years ago, they're claiming that King Jesus and this kingdom of love is the underground current of all the universe. And it doesn't matter what a Caesar, a Rome, a president can do for you. There's a power in love that is more powerful than anything else this world has to offer. So then what happens is the city authorities kind of throw up their hands and they're like, okay, what do we got again? Forgiveness, love, compassion, and you're not happy with it. We really don't know what to do with it. Please stop causing all this rabble. Just go home. Go to your homes. And that's how the story ends. It's amazing. And so it ends like that. And this is just one snapshot of what Paul was doing. And the book of Acts, this book we've been studying, for the rest of Acts, it will give us four freedom journeys, four experiences where Paul was going from city to city, declaring the kingdom of love, calling out that this new emerging kingdom, this gravitational pull to the universe is happening, and you can be a part of it now. So Paul, to a church in Galatians, said this, "For freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery." Early Christians longed and believed that through Jesus, the waters were parted, that your life could be new and renewed, that you could have the type of freedom that comes from love. And so then, the rest of the book, Paul goes on these incredible journeys across the entire Mediterranean Sea. So his first freedom journey happens in Acts 13:1 to 14:28. He visits 9 cities. He builds a friendship with Barnabas. He's stoned and left for dead in Iconium. He traveled 1,607 miles. Here's a map of what that looks like, his travel journey. Paul's second freedom journey in Acts 15 through Acts 18, he visits 19 cities. He built key friendships with Silas, Timothy, Lydia. Lydia is she's a sugar mama is what Lydia is. She's a single lady who deals in these fine purple cloths in the ancient world. And many, many people believe that she was funding the early Christian movement. And then we have Dionysius, Demeria, Aquila, and Priscilla, a couple that ministered across the world together. And then Crispus. Paul built churches in Philippi, in Thessalonica, in Berea, and Corinth. Paul was arrested in Philippi. And then this high moment in his life, he gives a speech on the Areopagus, this famous place where he talks to Stoic philosophers. It's kind of like you going to Yale and giving a speech there. And then in this journey, he travels 2,871 miles. This is what his journey looked like. Remarkable. Mostly on foot, maybe some horseback, and then, of course, on ships. His third freedom journey happens from 18 to chapter 21. He visits 18 cities. He builds key friendships with Erastus, Gaius, Aristarchus, and Apollos, the famous preacher. He survived a major riot in Ephesus. He traveled 2,947 miles. And then when you say things like Jesus is king and the emperor is not king, you typically don't curry favor. Finally, it caught up to him and he gets arrested. And I call it his fourth freedom journey because the way Acts tells you the story, Acts, I've told you from the beginning, it's meant to be humorous. It reads like a comic book at times where you're like, he's here, he's there. There's an uprising, there's a riot, he's in prison, and then he's arrested. And so chapter 21 to 28, he visits 11 cities on this journey he has to go to Rome because he appeals to Caesar in Rome. He has to defend that Jesus is king before the Jewish council, before the governor Felix, before governor Festus, before Agrippa, Bernice. He survives an epic shipwreck in the midst of all this. He travels 2,229 miles, and the book ends on this amazing crescendo of Paul is under house arrest in Rome, and people come to him day after day to tell them about Jesus. And you all say, dun, 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 dun. And that's how the book ends. And it leaves you on this incredible, like, wow. And so when you think about all that Paul, oh, there it is right there, his trip to Rome. Now remember, in Rome is like the Paris of the world, okay? Rome is the place you wanted to be, the epicenter of culture and coolness. And if you read Paul, he's always trying to get to Rome. And he finally makes it at the end of his life. And so when you think about, oh yeah, right, forgot this one. Check this out. I was thinking about this. Total miles of his journey, 9,654. If you started in San Diego, went all the way to Florida, all the way up to Maine, all the way over to Washington and back down, that it's roughly the same amount of miles. Incredible, except we have cars and planes. And so when you think about this incredible message of love that was being spread to the world, that Jesus is now the king, that nothing in your life is greater than God. Sometimes you think to yourself, wow, he did all that, but I can't be like that. I'll never travel the ancient Mediterranean Sea. I'll never be involved in shipwrecks and imprisonments and speak before Caesars and empires. Maybe you think, I'll never shake the president's hand. Or I'll never be in a flash mob in New York City under the bright lights on New Year's Eve. Or maybe you think to yourself, I'll never be able to turn the world upside down. What early Christians were saying to us is amazing. They were saying everywhere that Christians went, they were bringing life to a world that was flatlining. They were bringing the hope of love, forgiveness, and service to the world. When you have beat yourself down enough and talked yourself out of any type of passion and vision your life could have, you step outside, you walk to your mailbox like you do day after day, and you take out your mail and you separate the junk from the good stuff, bills. And then in your hand, after the bills go away, you feel something heavier than usual. You look down, and in your hand, in elegant calligraphy, is your name. You look on the back, and there's this imperial wax seal. You feel the heaviness in your hands. You've been given something important in this letter. So you break that wax seal, you open it up, and you read it.
My beloved friend, I know what you're going through. I know how hard it is. I'm familiar with your aches and pains. I won't tell you that it's going to be easy. Changing the world and yourself never is. There's a hunger inside of you for things to be different. I've felt your tears, been moved by your heartfelt cries, and listened to your fist-shaking anger. You long for the world to be right, just, fair for all. You want poor children in the southern hemisphere to be fed, clothed, and cared for. You want diseases like HIV, malaria, and cancer to be eliminated. You want bombs, bullets, and bloodshed to stop. I am the one who works underneath the surface of things. I fashion and form. I unsettle and reshape. I am, and I am not done. I will remake this world. There's a new empire that is not very empire-like. My kingdom of love is transforming the forces of hate and evil. My power is underground. Its strength comes from service, sacrifice, and selflessness of the masses, not the military, political, or presidential elite. It's going to take time, but trust me, change is beneath the surface, waiting to bloom. I'm making something new, something beautiful and bold. You can play a major role in all of this. You can bring life to a world that is flatlining. You can make a new world here and now. You can cross the raging sea. You can choose freedom, not slavery. You can sow seeds that one day will bloom. We can do this together. Here's what you can do. You can forgive the people who have wronged you. You can love those that are hard to love. You can stand up for those who are left out. You can become great through service to others. You can join movements that build up the most vulnerable. You can fill your home, heart, and street with singing and dancing. A new world is here, and when you shine, everyone will see it. Here's the promise that I'm making to you. I will open a way for you. I will stand beside you, and I will go before you. I will whisper my story in your ears day after day. I'll remind, renew, reawaken, and encourage you with my spirit over and over. I won't stop. You are not alone. I've also given you friends and family as fellow sojourners on this great adventure. When you are discouraged, please remember these things. You are loved. I created you, and I believe in you. You can only be you, and there will never be another you. You are my beloved friend. There is a reason you'll never be Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Mother Teresa, Dorothy Day, or Lady Gaga, because you are you, and I made you, and I have called you my beloved friend. When you find yourselves on the banks of the sea, hold someone's hand and step towards me. From the one who goes before you, walks beside you, dwells within you, and calls you to new adventures.